Well, hello again and welcome to another Berg Bite. It's a little while since we did one. In the meantime, we've been doing our recordings on European Works Councils. But I'm back today with another Berg Bite, and with me is Chris Heard, who's the Chief Executive of FirstBase. And FirstBase is a startup, a relatively recent startup, the last few years, and that helps companies that want to move towards remote working in terms of putting in place the systems, the structures, the hardwares and so on that makes remote work possible, effective and productive. And Chris actually started FirstBase a couple of years before COVID-19 hit us. He's been in pole position because of the experience he's garnered over the last couple of years to be able to work with companies who are moving towards remote working for the first time. So, hey, Chris, first of all, thanks for agreeing to talk to us and welcome to this, our Berg Bite. Tell me a bit about yourself. How did you actually stumble across helping companies to get to remote working as an actual business itself?
Yeah, we founded a financial technology company in March 2018 and initially took the decision to be remote first there because I never wanted to commute anymore. I wanted to spend more time with my family. I've got two young kids. My chief technology officer was about to have his first child. He wanted to be there to see him walk for the first time and laugh for the first time. And a little bit more selfishly, we also knew we'd be more talented and cost efficient if we were remote first. So we became a remote company and just started encountering some of the challenges and obstacles with operating that way. And something we were super passionate about was providing a great culture and experience. And that really began with the tools and equipment that people used in order to do their work. And as we got our first team members set up, we realized how expensive that was, how time consuming it was. Stuff never turned up. We lost equipment. It led to a terrible first experience. So we basically put our heads together, tried to solve that problem as best as we could, and built FirstBase as an internal product in that business. Fast forward 12 months, we finally come to the realization that that was the business we should be building, pivoted to that full-time in September 2019. By March 1st, we had 600 companies on our wait list, and we just crossed 6,500 on Monday. So yeah, a fairly wild ride since then.
Okay, so listen, take me back to the start. Tell me, because, you know, a lot of companies are now moving towards remote working for the first time. So tell me about the sort of problems that you ran into.
Yeah, it was mostly just getting the right tools and equipment to our team. So we just wanted to provide a great remote work experience. And in our mind, like, what was the best remote work experience on the planet? If you didn't have the right tools and equipment, how could you be as safe, comfortable and productive at home as you would be in an office? So we just started with that in mind. We wanted to provide people with desks, chairs, headsets, microphone, hardware. The hardware arrives, everything's already installed. The person doesn't have to waste 2-3 days trying to get that in there. And then on top of that, things that were more focused on ongoing culture and experience. So coffee machines, monthly coffee bean subscriptions. We've had banks ask us if we can do Peloton bikes and games consoles, things like that. So I think that was the thesis that we started with, that all these things were necessary to provide that great culture and experience. And then we just sort of went about solving that ourselves.
Okay, so look, I'm a company and what we Irish would call the emergency of the last 6 months is over. We've now decided to move towards remote working as part of our future business model, whether it's a fully remote model or a hybrid model with people coming in and out of the office and so on. So tell me, what do you consider the basics, the essentials, you know, before we get into cultural issues? What do you consider the basic sort of equipment issues to make this stuff work well?
Yeah, to your point, the emergency, people have reacted, and the base package that we would say is the emergency package is a desk, a chair, an additional monitor, and probably an external keyboard and mouse. And that's fairly simple.
What about sort of broadband connection?
I think we've seen that be less of an issue, but it's absolutely a key issue depending on where you live. So as you become more rural in your outlook, super fast internet becomes a problem. We haven't really encountered that yet, let's say, but I think it's something that's going to be increasingly prevalent as people do decentralize away from cities.
Okay, well, you know, see, this is fine. I have no kids. They're grown up, gone. Right? I have an office in my basement, so I don't have to use the kitchen table. But what I have a friend who for February, March, April, and into May, along with his partner, was living in a 30 to 40 square meter apartment in Barcelona with no balcony, no terrace, and was only allowed out once a day to do shopping. Now, how do you set up an effective remote working station in circumstances like that?
Yeah, and I think I would start with the caveat that the remote working we've been doing through a global pandemic is not necessarily reflective of what things are going to be like going forward. The second part is that I think the small apartments that people are forced to live in because of the high cost of living in cities is actually an implication of office work rather than an issue potentially with working remotely. So what we're seeing happening is people living in these big cities, whether it's Barcelona, New York, or San Francisco, are moving away from there to places that have lower costs of living. They have a far larger footprint in terms of the home that they can stay in, which gives them the space that they need to have secondary offices and things of that nature.
Let me come back to that issue in a couple of minutes, because, you know, sure, you know, I mean, I've made the point myself that I think over the long term that if remote working becomes a feature of companies' business models, then people are going to ask themselves the question, why am I living in this rat trap, you know, in the center of London when I could be living in, somewhere 50 miles away, 60 miles away, 100 miles away, or even further away, you know?
Yeah.
Not to mention those who work in professions that make enough money to allow them to have a villa in Spain and remotely work from there. But I mean, that's not something that's going to happen overnight, is it?
No, we certainly see this as a longer trend that we would call the unbundling of the city for the exact reasons that you touched upon. This was something that was already happening. The growth of remote work the prior decade before COVID was 400%. That's going to happen far more rapidly now as COVID's acted as the catalyst to accelerate remote working by 10 or 15 years. But still, we're talking 3, 5, 10 years from now where this really starts to happen at the scale that we imagine it will.
Yeah. But in the meantime, like Boris Johnson, for instance, in his recent speech to the Conservative Party conference, talked about how wonderful things are going to be in the UK in 10 years time. But what about the next year when you know, we still got COVID-19, when people are still stuck in small apartments? You know, as I say, oh, my kids are grown up, gone. So I don't have to worry about school. I don't have to worry about the school is closed. I'm trying to work. The kids are under my feet, you know?
Yeah.
How do you see those sort of things in the here and now?
Yeah, I think it's increasingly becoming less of an issue in the UK because schools have opened, which is giving parents an outlet to get their kids, obviously, out the house. You've still got the issues of two adults working in the same space. But as lockdown starts to ease, I often go and work in a coffee shop for 2 or 3 hours each morning. I think just being able to be a little bit more free in terms of the regulations around lockdown is helping us a lot. And I think what we're seeing already, personally, I probably know, 80 people that have moved away from London. They're now living outside Manchester or in Bristol or in my case in Scotland. And I think that's just a trend that's going to accelerate, whether it's in the short term and people return to London. But I think we're seeing the same thing happen in New York, where people are moving to places like Austin or the Midwest or San Francisco. They're moving to Colorado.
You mentioned something there that, we've used the phrase hybrid working in the past, you know, working from home and then maybe going into the office a couple of days a week and stuff like that. But I mean, doesn't remote working also mean, for instance, maybe the rebirth of the internet cafe, where, if there are two of you in the house and it's a small house until such time you can move, though, well, hey, this afternoon it's my turn to go to the internet cafe and tomorrow it's your turn and,
right,
and get away for a couple of hours.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely true. I think we're starting to see different takes on what I would call the third space emerge. So you're starting to see coffee shops or subscription clubs where people go to. I actually think the ultimate outcome to this is micro co-working spaces on every street. So let's say there's a street of 60 houses. maybe there's two houses are dedicated to these spaces where there's soundproof rooms, there's good coffee, there's access to on-demand fitness equipment like Peloton bikes or treadmills. And I think that is ultimately the outcome that we move towards.
And would you see, for instance, for example, an opportunity, let's say for a local hotel to reposition itself as such a center, you know, for instance, yeah. Obviously business meetings aren't taking place, so it has redundant business meeting space and so on, and weddings are restricted and whatever. Would you see an opportunity there for, you know, local pubs, cafes or whatever to get into this sort of?
100%. We actually spoke to a fairly large hotel chain yesterday about that exact thing.
Yeah. And how would you see that working? Like, you just, look, I go and I rent a table for an hour for a tenner or something like that, or that you have a subscription or whatever.
Yeah, I think it probably remains to be seen what the best route forward for them to monetize that is, whether it's a subscription where you get 3 or 4 hours a week, whether it's you pay on a by-use basis for the space or the food that you're consuming. But I think ultimately there's indications as to the route that that will go. I think the food model is probably the way that we'll see it emerge.
Okay. We've been talking a bit about hardware and premises and so on, but obviously one of the key considerations when it comes to remote working is the cultural issues, if I can put it that way, that are involved. You know, most people have been used to a life of commuting. Yeah, not me actually, but most people have been used to a life of commuting, getting up in the morning, getting the kids organized for school and so on. The two of them going their own way, coming home in the evening, whatever. Right? How was your day? Stuff. Right? And yet now when people are no longer doing that, no longer have their friends in the office, their circles and so on, and you have two people, you know, no matter of what gender or sex, stuck together all day, every day, that creates problems. Have you seen any evidence of that?
I think we've seen the opposite happen, actually. I think I've got sort of deep foundational questions as to the central part the office has started to play in the selection of our social circle. And I would question heavily whether our employers' HR teams should be the people selecting the people that we have closest social contact with. So that's not to say people don't make friends at the office. Obviously we do, in the same way that we did at school. But I think the reality is when you work remotely, you don't have to commute for 2 hours a day. You get to spend more time with the people that you choose. So the people, your friends, your family, your kids, you have more space to do hobbies where you can spend time with people that you have deep interest with rather just than the continued economic success of your employer.
So roll that back a bit. You said to me, a company's HR department should not be picking your friends for you. You know, expand on that for me, because there's going to be an awful lot of people looking at this who work in company HR departments that are going to say, what the hell was that all about?
Well, I think it's generally true. You look at the deep societal issues today around meaning, deep quality relationships that people need. And I think people's question around remote work is that it leads to isolation and loneliness. And I think my response to that would be, is that not what offices have started to create and why we're experiencing these issues in the first place? I think the relationships we have in offices are typically shallow, superficial relationships of a nature that you come into an office and you say, did you watch the football game last night or the show last night? And you never go any deeper than that. So it's people that you spend a lot of time with, but it's not really ever something where you build relationships.
Is that actually true? Because isn't there statistics which suggest that something like 20 to 30%, I remember saying it, but I didn't take note of it at the time, that 20 to 30% of all long-term relationships start at work.
So I think the statistics around marriages that happen at work are horrific, actually.
Yeah. But I mean, let me put it to you this way, you know, Chris. I mean, if you're stuck on a remote farm in the arsehole of Scotland, right, how are you ever going to meet anybody?
I mean, the way I met people is I had hobbies where I got to spend time with people that I shared deep interests with. So I was a semi-professional soccer player until 6 months ago. I do a lot of things out with that. So I think the reality is you go back 50 years, 30 years, people's interests outside of work were a lot deeper than they are today, whether it was from the church, whether it was interest groups that they went to, whether it was the pub that they drank in. Today, we've just outsourced the curation and maintenance of our relationships to our employers and let it happen in offices.
Now, listen, before I come back to that, because, you know, you're touching on sort of the bowling alone phenomenon here. And you better answer this question correctly. Who did you play soccer for?
I played in the Highland League in Scotland. So we played in the Scottish Cup a few times. We got beat by the Hibs of the world and the lower league teams.
Now, listen, make my day and tell me you didn't play for anybody like Liverpool or Manchester City or any of those teams that the other team and its supporters in Manchester don't like.
Never.
That's okay. You passed that particular test. Yeah. But listen, what you're touching on there is, you know, the phenomenon that was identified in that book. I can't quite remember the author's name at the moment. Some years back in the States, of bowling alone, the disappearance of associations and societies and clubs, and, you know, sort of an atomization of society. And I mean, it, to an extent, isn't remote working where we're working on our own and only connecting on media like this, you know, a further manifestation of that sort of cultural phenomena? You know, I mean, if I'm interested, I'm a Manchester United fan, right? You know, when I lived in Brussels, I go to the pub with my other Manchester United fans and whatever, right? And you're not going to do that now. You know, I was a stamp collector or, you know, a bird watcher or whatever. You can't do those things. And work was one of those places where we did come together socially. Whether it was shallow or not, it was at least a pool of people that we dealt with, some of whom we hated, of course, right? Let's never forget that, right?
I mean, yeah, look, I think if you look at it from the perspective of, let's say you worked for a company where 5,000 people were there, maybe when you leave that company, you've got long-term relationships with three of them. But I think the problem with office work that's manifested in the last 10 or 15 years is that when you leave a company, typically those social relationships end. Now, I think in your example, whether it's Man United fans, whether it's, in my example, playing football over long periods of time, whether it's, I don't know, rock climbing clubs, those relationships are built on a far deeper common interest rather than the continued economic success of the person who pays our wages, where when that ends, the relationship ends.
I'm not quarreling with you about that. It's a bit like, you know, in a way, you know, those people you meet on holidays and you spend 2 weeks right. And I beat it drinking with them and you say, we'll keep in touch afterwards, and you never do, you know. And I know that, I mean, when you leave a job, you typically sort of look back for about 6 months and then that's it. You know, life moves on. But yet at the same time, you did make the point that through every job we pass through, we might end up with two or three lifelong relationships as a result of that. I know I have, right? You know, what does concern me a little bit about, you know, is how do we, if we're remote, you know, are our only accessible immediate the people who live in our neighborhood, you know? And of course, I worry a little bit about that. By the way, I speak from 30 years of experience of working remotely. As I said to you yesterday, I started doing this before the fax was even invented. You know, in those days we had to use carrier pigeons. But look, doesn't this also raise the question of, I mean, how do you onboard, a phrase I hate, by the way, but, you know, how do you bring people into an organization? Like, it's fine for me, you know, I know all of the people I work with, I know, I've met over the years, right? But hey, I'm a 22, 23-year-old just leaving college or whatever it might be, you know, I know nothing, right? How do I get socialized and inducted into an organization? And how do I learn, the apprenticeship skills, never mind the theoretical intellectual knowledge that I picked up at college, but, you know, the practical, how do you do stuff in the real world knowledge, if I can't sit beside somebody or work with them? How do you see that?
Yeah, I think my initial reaction is that it's somewhat overblown in terms of the osmosis that happens inside organizations. I think the hard skills are actually far easier to pass on. And I think the generation that's coming into the workforce now have actually grown up building relationships via virtual messaging and other platforms. So I think they are intrinsically more capable of doing that than other generations have been. I think the second part is that just because we're remote doesn't mean that we never come together in person. So I think for initial people that come into organizations, whether there's a synchronous element where they're on site for a period of time that enables them to acquire the types of, I think in many ways, the intangible soft skills that people think that they need to be professionals, I think that's entirely true. And then longer term, I think as people stay with organizations, it's about a cadence of how often are we going to come together in person. So just because you're remote doesn't mean that you never meet up with your team. There's different cadences in organizations depending on the problems that they're solving. That might be once a week, once a month, once a quarter. And I think when you work in a manner like that, those times where you are together are of far higher quality because you actually do really build relationships in that time. And you need to have far more trust as well when you are working remotely.
You mentioned when we started that you had 650 people a couple of months back on your waiting list, and now it's got over 6,000 and so on. So obviously you're talking with a lot of people a lot of the time. What are you hearing from them?
I think what we're hearing, I would caveat this with the fact that people are clearly self-selecting for the conversations they're having with us. We're not speaking to people that aren't going remote because they wouldn't want to speak to us about the product that we're using. But certainly what we're hearing is that from the companies that speak to us, around 30% are never going to have an office again going forward. They're going to be fully remote first. Around 60 to 70% are saying that they're going to be more hybrid, which is 2 to 4 days working from home, 1 to 2 days working in an office.
Okay. And how quickly, are those trends already taking hold, or are we still inching towards them?
I think the reality is the 7 months that we've all been forced to work remotely, as in we companies that weren't used to this, there are deep behaviors and habits that have calcified across that. And because this is going to persist for another 5, 6, 7 months anyway, potentially until next summer, by that point, people have worked remotely for 12 to 14 months, and it becomes incredibly difficult for them to expect to go back to commuting 2 hours a day. They're just not going to do it. And if you try to force them to, companies are going to lose their most talented people to their biggest competitors.
Yeah, look, tell me something I don't know. When your daily commute consists of 30 seconds from the bedroom to the kitchen, going back to a 2-hour commute into the center of London or New York or whatever is not so. And when you don't have to sort of get up at 6 o'clock in the morning to make sure you have the kids organized to get them out of school, and you can still be productive, That's, I don't think people want to go back from that.
I agree.
So, who are going to be the winners and the losers as we move to remote working? So let me give you an example. I mentioned that in other circumstances, I might have been running a training program in Sitges in Barcelona this time. We ran 3 meetings a year in the same hotel for the last 10 years. We put a chunk of change into that hotel. Good friends of ours. We're obviously not doing that at the moment. Right? Now magnify that out. Right? So not only is that hotel losing, the local restaurants are losing. In our case, the local bars are definitely losing, and not to mention the transport links. So do you see industrial sectors from what you're hearing, winners and losers?
Yeah, and I think you've seen the same thing being sprouted by the UK government around Pret a Manger losing all its customers. And I think that is almost entirely putting the cart before the horse. And by that, I mean that most of these sectors that exist to serve people around the economy of the office will redistribute to wherever they need to be to service people based on the decentralization away from big cities. And in the same way that the Pret a Mangers of the world will move from having 300 locations in London, maybe they have one location in 300 different towns because people are working remotely more often. And I think we'll see the same thing happening with hotels, where there become these almost resort-like off-sites where people can go to, they can hold the events that you're talking about. There's facilitators on site. They're more designed for those specific interactions, and they become a far higher quality place to go for that specific thing, rather than an all-purpose hotel that's obviously great at doing a number of different things.
Okay, so look, before I wrap this up with you, now let me ask you a question. I'm a company thinking of going remote. I phone you up. What can you do for me?
So FirstBase helps companies by providing them a platform that lets them supply, finance, and manage all the physical equipment remote workers need at home. So we effectively enable you to click a button, and then we handle everything from the financing of that, rather than having to pay £3,000 to £5,000, euros, dollars up front. You pay us as a monthly subscription. We handle the entire logistical back end, getting the stuff to the workers, the ongoing maintenance and repairs, the collections if a worker leaves. So that's how we handle that. And I think that's a big and increasingly challenging problem that organizations have as they go increasingly remote.
So a one-stop shop, and you know, I outsource my remote working logistics.
You got it.
Setup and logistics to you guys.
Yep.
Okay. And what about, do you venture into the area of what I might call psychological and cultural support as well, or is that sort of next on the list?
Yeah, it's on the roadmap. So we're certainly going into the area of providing things that are more focused on ongoing culture and experience. So things like coffee machines, coffee bean subscriptions. There's people have asked us, can we provide subscriptions to things like Headspace or Calm, different apps that people use to get those things, but we're not quite there yet.
Okay. Now look, I was a company looking at my options, you know, what do you think is the fundamental question I have to ask myself and address and answer?
Yeah, I think the biggest one we see organizations asking is, does remote work enable us to be more talented? And I think the answer to that is absolutely true. Rather than hiring the best person in a 30-mile radius of an office, you get to hire the best person on the planet that you can afford. Mm. And number two is around cost efficiency. If we're paying £20,000 to £50,000, dollars, euros a year per workspace in an office per worker, are we better placed spending $2,000 a year to provide the best remote work experience on the planet while simultaneously increasing the talent in our organization? So I think the question is, like, there's almost a remote prisoner's dilemma at play here, where companies that don't go remote are going to be less cost efficient, but they're also going to be less talented.
Okay, well, one last question. Working with the companies you've been working with over the past while, have you run across any data protection or data privacy problems? You know, from a company perspective, has data leaked? And from an individual point of view, are you seeing an increase in companies looking, how do we monitor remote workers? And is that giving rise to issues?
I think we've certainly seen people being mindful of it. So we haven't seen any issues of that happening. But we've seen instances where companies have said certain types of work can't happen outside of an office where we can control the environment that it happens inside. And I think increasingly that's what we're going to see going forward. There's obviously issues with certain types of work being done on certain types of data, whether it's for financial data, whether it's HIPAA compliance information. But we've certainly not seen any issues from that perspective with companies yet.
And have you seen any complaints from any employees that they've been over surveyed or over monitored or anything like that come across your radar?
I think we're beginning to see some complaints about that on social media. So none of the companies we're working with, but I think you are starting to see some companies with what I would call a surveillance capitalism approach, whether that's tracking, clicks of a mouse, screen recording, things like that. And I think there's going to be two routes that companies go with that. Some who do that, others who trust their people to do work, who are going to be the beneficiaries of that trust.
Okay, Chris, listen, thanks for taking the time to talk to us. When we put this out there, we'll put your contact details on it. So anybody wants to come and talk to you, they know where to find you. I suspect we may come back and talk to you in, let's say, 6 months' time, if not before then, about as things evolve and develop. But I myself tend to agree with you that I don't think we're going back to where things were last year. Where we're going exactly, I think, still needs to be finally mapped and decided, but there's no going home again. Okay, Chris, thanks. Appreciate your time. Yeah.